Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
In my situation, there was a serial rapist that was responsible for the crime, and that information was available for people to see and should have been disclosed by the prosecution, and had it been even disclosed prior to my appeals in the Saskatchewan Appeal Court, I would have been released.
It was such a heartbreaking situation. It's the voice of David Milgaard. David passed away not so long ago. And as you know, he served. You can't even say served. He was abused. He was forced into prison for 23 years for a murder he did not commit. The rapist, the serial rapist he was referencing in that clip in a conversation we had with David, and I got to know him reasonably well over the years, was Larry Fisher. He was right there for the police in Saskatchewan, but they didn't grab him, they grabbed David. And David was in prison for 23 years of his life, starting as a very young man. It was outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. And it's because David's mother confronted then Prime Minister Brian Mulroney in public. And let's give Brian Mulroney all the credit for what he did. He didn't have much choice because the national media was there. Well, he could have ignored it, but he didn't. And eventually, David was released. And I remember him saying to me, they put him in a halfway house because they hadn't quite decided what ultimately they were going to do with him once they realized that he wasn't guilty. They'll just send you on your way. David had to be back at the halfway house at a specific time, let's say 9 p.m. And he was a little late, and he was in violation of his release. So he was afraid he might be sent back to prison. And I asked him, David, what were you doing? He said, I was outside, lying in the grass, looking at the sky, because I hadn't seen it for so long at night. So a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Bobby Mailman and Wally Gillespie. They were found innocent of the murder charge they were convicted of in the 1980s, after they both spent many years imprisoned. And a couple of weeks ago, New Brunswick's Justice Minister, let me change this around a bit. Mr. Mailman is 76. He's dying of liver cancer. Mr. Gillespie is living in poverty with barely enough to eat. He likely had access to more food while imprisoned. So what happens when two individuals who are found guilty of murder when they were innocent are acquitted, which happened in New Brunswick when the Chief Justice presided over a retrial? Now remember, the first trial, they convicted them first-degree murder. Second trial didn't even last half a day. Crown attorney got up and said, we have no evidence. We have no reason for this trial to go forward. We recommend acquittal. Done. So what's happening with these two men, 76 and 80? Mr. Mailman is dying of liver cancer. And what got me onto this story is that one of our guests made me aware by way of email that New Brunswick's Justice Minister Ted Fleming and his department are entirely silent on the issue of Bobby Mailman and Wally Gillespie. And how difficult and lengthy a process can it be for the innocent who are convicted of crime, perhaps particularly murder, to receive recognition and compensation for many years spent wrongfully imprisoned? How difficult is the reintegration into society following such an experience? Is there always a cloud of doubt which follows a finding of being convicted, though innocent? How does an 80-year-old man restart his life after decades in prison? The 76-year-old man is dying. What a terrible reality. And the Justice Minister of New Brunswick, he's not saying anything. He doesn't care. Ron Dalton knows what it's like to be convicted of murder. When you're innocent, he was convicted of murdering his wife. Spent 12 years in prison. In the same prison with Bobby Mailman and Wally Gillespie. And Ron Dalton waited 12 years for forensic evidence to find him innocent. Sadly, Mr. Dalton's wife had died from choking on a piece of breakfast cereal, which the young doctor at the hospital in Newfoundland didn't recognize. So Ron Dalton is back with us, president of Innocence Canada, and it was Innocence Canada's work, that diligent work, that created the reality of the freedom for Bobby Mailman and Willie Gillespie. How are you, Ron?
Good afternoon, Roy, to you and your listeners.
You know, each time I talk to you, I marvel at the fact that you're as calm, collected, focused, and objective in your conversation. I never hear anger. I just hear determination to carry on with the work of Innocence Canada, and that is to secure the acquittal of men and women in Canada's prisons who must be acquitted because they're innocent. How do you manage that?
I have to confess, Roy, that if I need to find a little anger, I can reach down and find it. But frankly, I haven't found it very productive. I didn't find it productive during the time I was in prison, because the people in the next cell to me had their own sad story to tell. The people walking the hallways with the keys weren't the ones that put me in there, and they weren't the ones that could get me out of there. And even working on cases like Bobby and Wally's case, and I met these gentlemen 34 years ago when I was serving a life sentence alongside of them, railing and being angry and kicking at the system doesn't work. We've had to meticulously take apart their case to the point that 3 weeks ago when they stood up in court, pled not guilty to the same charge, the Crown had to then stand and say, we have no evidence to offer. What little evidence they had 40 years ago was no longer there. We had taken that apart. Witnesses that had been paid were no longer reliable. The alibi that they had been strengthened and proven. And there was literally nothing to tie them to this horrible crime. And it was a horrible crime. There was a man beaten and set on fire. It just wasn't by Mr. Mailman and Mr. Gillespie.
Mm-hmm. And they had, during the trial, there were witnesses who placed them both at the time the crime was committed, many kilometers away from the crime scene.
Both on the police payroll, as it turns out, and being paid for their testimony.
Never mind. That's starting to sound like David Milgaard.
Well, there's always similarities in these cases. And poor old my friend David not only served 23 years in prison, he was out on parole for 5 or 6 before we were able to demonstrate his innocence. And in doing so, actually identified Larry Fisher. So David punched in 30 years. He was 16 when all this started. He told me he was a 40-year-old teenager when he got out of prison.
Yeah.
Not sure much in a place like that.
Yeah. Wynne Warrer is the Director of Client Services for Innocence Canada. I've known Wynne by way of phone calls and emails for what, 25, 30 years?
Yes. I've been doing this for the organization's 31 years old, but I started really 32 years ago.
You're an amazing person, and you've seen so much, and you've experienced so much, and yet you as well are always objective, when I'm sure anger could easily be an emotion that you would display. What is your feeling? What do you feel about the Bobby Mailman and Wally Gillespie story? Because it was from you, Wynne, that I found out that New Brunswick's justice minister appears to care not a whit about them or any compensation they might be due.
I think, you know, when you're doing this work, you've always got to have hope. You've got to, you know, despite the, you know, what you see people go through, because the one thing that I'm grateful for is people like Ron, who's one of the exonerees, who himself was wrongly convicted, as you've said. is their indomitable spirit, their unwillingness to give up or to give in. And I always considered it a gift that they trusted me enough to allow me to help them if I could, or the organization to help them. And without them, I call them the heroes, because they are heroes, because they just refused to lie. You know, they could have, well, many of them were offered plea deals that they could have taken and gotten out of prison earlier, or, you know, but they refused to do. And in the case of Bobby Mailman and Wally Gillespie, Wally was collateral damage. I mean, they wanted Bobby Mailman, but Wally refused to lie. And, you know, something has to be said for people like Wally, because despite the horrible set of circumstances he found himself in, and that they were, you know, basically waving, you know, a carrot in front of his nose, basically saying, you take this and you know, and you don't have to go through this. But in actual fact, he refused to do it. He refused to lie. So it is the people that I get to know, the people who become, I call them my extended family, and they very much are my extended family. And, you know, and Bobby and Wally, I've known since the 90s. I've seen, you know, what they've been through while in prison. I've seen since they've been out of prison. And you can't help but admire and respect people who have been through what they've been through. And that, as you said, you know, I asked Wally, because somebody asked me, and I just asked Wally just to see what his answer would be about anger. And his answer was pretty much the same as Ron's. What would it get him to be angry? Where would that, you know, where would that lead him, you know, except it would destroy him as a person, because he would just be, his, you know, he would be just filled with anger and bitterness, and that gets us nowhere. Reuben Hurricane Carter used to say, it consumes the vessel that contains it.
Yeah, Reuben Hurricane Carter, middleweight boxing champion of the world, was wrongfully convicted of murder, and he was right in this studio, right where I'm sitting now. He was sitting to the right of me, and we did 2 hours conversation with him, maybe 30 years ago. And it's quite an amazing, amazing story. Innocence Canada, by the way, small organization, volunteers, not a lot of money. They work terribly hard. And if you can provide any financial support to Innocence Canada, it would be greatly appreciated. InnocenceCanada.ca. Ron, when it comes to the issue of compensation for time spent in prison, the years spent in prison, knowing you're not guilty, knowing you're innocent, what happens when you're released? Are you contacted by governments and who say, oh, we're very sorry, Mr. Dalton, we're very sorry, Mr. Mailman, we're very sorry, Mr. Gillespie, we want to make this as right as we can, let's sit down and negotiate what you think would be an appropriate amount of money to let you rebuild, or at least build your life? What happens, Ron?
Well, guaranteed that's not what happens, Roy. Quick correction. Last time you and I spoke, I let you say .ca, and Wynn was quick to correct me that it's .com.
Okay, InnocenceCanada.com.
You can still find us. You punch in Innocence Canada and we'll pop up.
Okay,
The reality is that none of those things happen, unfortunately. There's no mechanism in the Canadian Criminal Code for compensating victims of wrongful convictions, because they never expected that anything like that would ever happen. But it happens all too regularly. 3 days ago, the Premier of New Brunswick held an hour-long event with the Fredericton Chamber of Commerce. He called it the State of the Province Address. They do it annually. He spoke for an hour about a bunch of wonderful things that's happening in New Brunswick, and lots of things are. The offered a $300 payment to households making less than $70,000 a year in what many are speculating will be an election year. On the way out of that event, there was a little media scrum, and the Premier was asked about Mr. Mailman and Mr. Gillespie. He initially tried to duck the question, but when he did respond, what he said was he'll seek advice, he'll do the right thing at the end of the day. And we all know what the right thing is. You stand up and man up and admit that you made a mistake, that your government, the people of New Brunswick that you represent, the people 40 years ago working on your behalf, got it wrong. You own up to your mistakes. You compensate the victims as best you can.
40 years later, a little bit of money to make their lives a little easier. Mr. Mailman's case in the few days he has left. I spoke to him for half an hour today, and he's in very difficult circumstances. And as you said, Mr. Gillespie's 80 years old. This could all happen in a 20-minute conversation between their legal representatives and the premier and attorney general in New Brunswick, who to this point have been silent. The federal justice minister overturned their convictions. The chief justice of New Brunswick found them not guilty, and the following day apologized in writing on behalf of the courts. We haven't heard a thing from the New Brunswick justice minister or the premier. And I hearken back to our mutual friend, David Milgaard, who shortly before he died called Brian Mulroney in typical David fashion. We were lobbying at the time for the feds to put in an independent, publicly funded body to do the type of work that we do. And David called Mulroney, who wasn't at home, but got back to him within a half hour. And David said, how do we get this thing moving? And former Prime Minister Mulroney told him, he said, David, he said, nothing happens in Ottawa until the Prime Minister says so. But when the Prime Minister says so, things can happen pretty quickly.
Okay.
We're in an analogous situation in New Brunswick.
Ron, we have to pick this up. Again, there's much more to be said. Much more to be said. It's in the interest of everybody in this country, because the next person innocently convicted could be anybody.
Do not surrender to the advance of the state. The state is not the solution. The state is the problem itself. You are the true protagonists of this story. And rest assured that as from today, Argentina is your staunch, unconditional ally. Thank you very much, and long live freedom. Damn it.
I would vote for that guy. I just like him. I like his approach. That's what's happening in a lot of parts of the world. People who are deemed unelectable suddenly are elected. I'm not suggesting that they all should be elected. But I like the way Mealy presents himself. Anybody who ends a presentation of the World Economic Forum with, what did he say?
And long live freedom. Damn it.
Yeah, exactly. Tom, you're good. Tom Craig, who flies this thing. And answers the phone when you call in. Just a tremendous work for us. And it has been a bit of a challenging weekend, hasn't it? And last weekend too, not just my voice. But we got through it. And the reward is we get the opportunity now to speak to our great friend and executive editor of Blacklock's reporter at Minding Ottawa on X or Twitter, whichever you prefer. I don't imagine we'll ever decide on one or the other, not as long as Elon Musk has $246 billion. He's just slightly less wealthy than Tom Korski.
But that's speaking of me, there's a, when you say it's a reward, I say, like, what's first prize? Like, this is sort of like the second prize. There must have been something better.
How are you, Mr. Korski?
I'm well, Roy. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. So let's talk about some of the stories that you've covered and continue to carry on Blacklock's reporter at Minding Ottawa. So fairly eagle-eyed folks on Twitter. I still say Twitter. And if Elon Musk ever calls me, I'll start calling it X. I'd love to talk to him. Anyway, some eagle-eyed folks saw that at David Lametti was gone. It had disappeared from X or Twitter. And now Lametti's disappeared from Ottawa. And this is after the federal court made the decision, not an opinion, which the Liberals like to suggest is what the Supreme Court's decision concerning the No More Pipelines Act was. No, it was the decision that Mr. Trudeau and his government that violated the charter rights of you, Tom, of me, and every Canadian by enacting the Emergencies Act or invoking it. So talk to us about Lametti.
Absolutely. By the way, the deletion of his Twitter account is a very significant sidebar. There have been serious concerns expressed by archivists, researchers, serious people, Roy, that so much public business is now conducted electronically, and it's not like when you had to get a truck backed up to the Prime Minister's office and take the old cabinet minutes and paper form down to the National Archives so future historians forevermore could understand what the MacDonald cabinet was thinking when they built the Canadian Pacific Railway. What did Dave Lametti say in direct messages about this fundamental court ruling? Well, now we'll never know. And maybe that's transitional right now. In 50, 60 years, historians may care a great deal. At the moment, it is the epilogue of Dave Lametti's political career. He was the Attorney General. He was dead wrong. It was interesting. None of the Freedom Convoy, my two cents, Roy, none of the Freedom Convoy saga makes sense to anyone outside of Ottawa, unless you appreciate that Ottawans are unhinged on the subject of the Freedom Convoy. I say this as an Ottawa ratepayer. For the sake of friendship, of associations, co-workers, neighbors, we do not talk about the Freedom Convoy because people in this town are berserk on the subject. You listen to them, and they sound like they survived the bombing of Coventry. Dave Lametti, and we know this because of documents obtained by a judicial inquiry, Dave Lametti wet his pants. He was the Attorney General. He said he was personally scared. He felt personally threatened. He left town. It was that bad. But did anyone threaten? Did anyone say, hey, Lametti, you're getting it? No. It was the signage. He didn't like the Trudeau signs and the honking. And as a result, in the immortal words of the then chief clerk of the Privy Council, Secretary to Cabinet, they decided to drop, quote-unquote, the full weight of government on those political protesters. And you just had a federal court judge say you were wrong in law. There was no violence. You want lawlessness? That's what happened at the cabinet table. That's a wow, Roy.
That is a big wow. And it's particularly interesting that it's a judge who, I suppose, I mean, it's been said that he has liberal leanings personally. But when he looked at the law, when he looked at the Emergencies Act and the circumstances under which it was invoked, said, no matter, I'm paraphrasing, I may have some thoughts or some empathy for what you were thinking, but you were wrong. I think that's significant. And you write in Black Box Reporter, Lametti still said he was proud of his service, made no mention of the EA court ruling and said, I am proud of this legacy. So what that sounds like to me, Tom, is this line. When you're being run out of town, get out in front. Make it look like a parade.
Which is exactly what he did. By the way, that judge in the case, Judge Mosley, 74, which means he's about to retire. This was his legacy. And he was a Liberal cabinet appointee. Paul Martin cabinet appointed him. And he was a lifelong Crown Counsel. He's lived in Ottawa for 50 years. This was an establishment guy. And whether the defendants, the Department of Justice, picked Judge Mosley, and by the way, there, such things do occur. The federal court, we like to think, is sterlingly independent. In many ways, quite often, it's just another federal bureaucracy. But Judge Mosley did his job. 190-page ruling was absolutely devastating. And they say cabinet instantly. I find it hard to believe that there were members of cabinet who read all 190 pages before they rushed to the microphone and said, we're going to appeal this, and then recycled all the old speeches about how scared they were. Right. This is a low water mark, right? Every spring they observe the anniversary of the Charter of Rights and Observance of Civil Liberties in our country. This is a low water mark. This is going to be the worst charter day ever.
Here's what Chrystia Freeland said.
We have discussed it with the Prime Minister, with cabinet colleagues, with senior federal government officials and experts. We respect very much Canada's independent judiciary. However, we do not agree with this decision.
So there, Tom, there's a verbalization of pain.
It's going to get more painful.
I know.
And I'll tell you why. This is inevitably going to the Supreme Court.
Yep.
What did the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court say in an April 9, 2022 interview with the Le Devoir, Quebec Daily? He likened the Freedom Convoy to anarchists and hostage takers. I'm quoting. This is the Chief Justice of the highest court of a G7 country. Quote, what we saw on Wellington Street here was the beginning of anarchy, where certain people decided to take other citizens hostage, to take the law into their own hands, unquote. That's Chief Justice Wagner. This is going to be the guy who's hearing the case. You know, there's some lawlessness and anarchy going on, but it's not the people who were having Macarena dances and cooking hot dogs for the kids on Wellington Street. It happens to be the people who, Dave Lametti, this guy was a professor of law at McGill University.
Yes, he was.
Right? Pretty good law school.
Was he not the dean at McGill Law?
I think he was. For some reason, they don't want him back now, but whatever.
I wonder why.
Exactly. These are supposed to be our betters. They're supposed to be the learned ones. If you become Attorney General or you're Supreme Court Chief Justice, you don't get to be scared or irritated by people who are expressing a political opinion to which you disagree. Everyone should feel very strongly about that.
Well, I feel very strongly that the Chief Justice, having made those statements, should recuse himself from participating in the Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, they never do, though.
No, they don't.
We found one instance. It was a copyright case. It was a rather inept judgment. It was Access Copyright v. York University. The judge who wrote the judgment, Justice Abella, now retired, her husband was a former employee and pensioner of York University. Are you kidding me? In police court, they would call that a conflict of interest. At county council, they would say, oh, you shouldn't really do that, Rose. This is where we are.
What about all the family members and friends of the minister who were placed on the bench in New Brunswick, the federal minister for public safety? We don't want to bring that up. Was it 500 or 600 of them?
Okay. This is anarchy, Roy. You are off the rails.
Somebody sent me an email and said, aren't you tired? Aren't you scared of pissing people off? No, it's what I do.
That is what you do, Roy.
It's what
I do.
So
well.
It's what I do. When you're being run out of town, get out in front. Make it look like a parade.
Gold.
So I remember, Tom, the exact moment I realized it was over for Justin Trudeau. And the exact moment I realized his political career was going to start going downward was when he went to Quebec and collected one Stephen Guilbeault, president of Équiterre. And we can imagine what Équiterre is or was.
He wanted an SUV tax. That's right.
That's right. And he brought him to Parliament. And Mr. Guilbeault's gift to Canadians is the carbon tax. But at Blacklock's Reporter, you point to the tax on the tax and how much it's worth to the government. Tell us about that.
Well, it's interesting, Roy. The government has always said that the tax is revenue neutral. In fact, the finance minister has said that frequently, repeatedly, at the House of Commons Committee, Commons Finance Committee, revenue neutral. But it's not. It's subject to the GST. This is the famous, infamous tax on tax. There was back in the day, there was a former Conservative MP, Mark Warawa, from Langley, B.C., who introduced a bill. This was, oh my goodness, this is 7 years ago, in which he wanted to stop any GST collections on the carbon tax. Well, they don't. And what is it worth? It's worth almost $500 million this year. That is the carbon tax charge with the GST, the GST on top of the tax on the tax. $486 million this year. So that's not revenue neutral. That's big money.
Mm-hmm. And when you buy gasoline, I'm sure it's still the way it was a number of years ago. Every liter of gasoline that you purchase, which has provincial tax and federal tax, has the GST piled on top of that tax. So there's another tax on taxes.
Your natural gas bill, absolutely.
Yeah. So I've been wondering, and I've been waiting with bated breath No, I haven't. But I've been waiting for the news on the ArriveCan app and the Auditor General's decision. Please, Mr. Korski, fill us in.
This is a big deal, and it's worth marking the day. Monday, I'm looking at a calendar now, the February 12th, that's the Monday, second Monday in February, Auditor General Hogan is going to release a report, a special audit, by order of the House of Commons. Opposition MPs overruled Cabinet's objections on this. A special audit of ArriveCan. This is the famous app everyone recalls, cross-border travelers, pre-submission of proof of vaccination in the heyday of the pandemic. Well, what's interesting about that? There's no way to make this pretty, Roy. Federal managers lied to the House of Commons about what it cost. They said it cost $19 million, and it didn't. It cost more than double that, $54 million. How could you possibly spend $54 million on an app? Well, they discovered that there were brokers, contractors, sole-sourced contractors. These were guys who knew just who to call, who were paid millions in commissions. There are contractors who became millionaires off this deal. An audit has been ordered. It will be released. This is highly unusual. Auditors are going to meet for 2 hours in closed session with MPs and staff to take questions, and then go into a special session of the Commons Public Accounts Committee in public, approximately 11:15 Eastern, Monday, February 12th, and she's going to talk about the disclosure. What's the takeaway here, Roy? This is why we think this is very noteworthy. There's no real suspicion or allegation that there was political direction in here. This is worse. This is federal managers. These are guys on the golf course. They were not directed by any cabinet minister. These were senior managers at the Canada Border Services Agency, and they know they had a friend, and I know a guy. So let's go back to the clubhouse and have a couple of drinks, and we're going to work this out. If you do that in Zaire, they call it corruption. When you do that in Ottawa, they say, we did a great job. I'm proud of my service. This is a bad one, Roy.
And I call it Ad Scam 2024.
That's what it is.
So Stephen Harper's vilified by the Prime Minister and his cabinet, except maybe not so much. Tell us about that.
Well, Roy, I know that you're a young man. You won't appreciate this, but if you live long enough, everything kind of comes around. Stephen Harper,
oh my.
Around 2009, saw that there was a large increase in the number of Mexicans who were claiming asylum in Canada. And the vast majority of these refugee claimants were bogus. They were false. Costs a lot of money. So the cabinet of the day, 2009, remember that there's about approximately 9,000, 10,000 refugee claimants a year from Mexico. Harper brought in a visa. He said, you cannot step on a plane as a Mexican national and fly to Canada unless you first get a visa. Well, this was seen as demeaning. And in fact, there was a Mexican ambassador said, this is demeaning. We're part of NAFTA now. Where do you get off, Harper? So when cabinet came in, the Liberal cabinet 2016, they repealed that. What happened? Well, we lived long enough. And what happened is what was 9,000 Mexican refugee claimants fell to as low as 120 a year under the visa requirement, took away the visa rule, never guess what happened. It went to 23,000 is the backlog now at the Immigration Refugee Board. Number one source country for refugee claimants in Canada. It's not Russia. It's not China or North Korea. It's Mexico. It's unbelievable. Cabinet, obviously, is now going to bring back the visa. They just don't want to announce that because that's, you know, it's embarrassing, right?
Yeah, and I interviewed Stephen Harper about that in 2009. I remember that. Well, I love the line. I've never heard it before. What goes around comes around. Never heard that before. Thank you, Tom. Thanks so much. Always great talking to you. Thank you. This is an issue that's been talked about a great deal, written about a great deal, and there are so many opinions out there, and I've talked to so many people about it, and it's the issue of the Safer Supply of Drugs program. How effective is this? And it's for drug-addicted people. They have access to a safer supply of drugs like heroin and fentanyl and other drugs to help them in their difficult times. Now, is it actually doing that job? There are communities, people in communities who say, no, where these drugs are made available very close by, they wind up with issues that are very difficult to deal with and abuse of these drugs. So is it a success? Is it a failure? So that's part one of what we're going to talk about as far as the drugs are concerned. The other one has to do with chronic pain patients, and we'll get into this issue before the end of the hour. Chronic pain patients, and we've talked a lot about this on the program. I talked to a widow of a chronic pain patient who took his own life because he was refused the continuance of what was a very successful and physician-supervised program of opioids for him. Just couldn't get them anymore, so he shot himself in the head. I'm not going to soft coat this stuff. It's real. And I'm very happy to speak with Dr. Brian Conway, medical director and infectious diseases specialist at the Vancouver Infectious Diseases Center. Dr. Conway knows what this is all about. Dr. Conway, thank you very much for coming on the program.
Well, it's been too long, Roy. And before we get into the subject matter at hand, I know you've been very public about sharing some of your own health issues, and I wish you well. And I would like to send a shout out to all these guys that are a little less young than they used to be. If all of a sudden you have to get up twice a night to pee, this is not normal. This is not you just getting older. You need to have this checked out.
Yeah.
So let's do that. And Roy, I wish you well.
Thank you, Dr. Conway. I really appreciate that. And I was stupidly in denial about exactly that. I was taking longer to pee, and it says, it'll take care of itself. That's nothing. Well, it turned out to be something, and it's something very serious. But I'm still on the right side of the carpet, and I'm being well-treated by our healthcare system, which is under duress, as you know. But I do appreciate your thoughts and your support, Dr. Conway. On this issue of safer supply of drugs, what's the objective here, in layman's terminology? It's been around for a while. It's being criticized as being a dangerous program. What's your assessment of it?
Well, it's not black and white. I think that the theory is that as the street supply of drugs gets more toxic and puts a person who buys it at risk of an overdose, if not death, the idea is if they had access to other opioids that were prescribed, such as the safer supply, they would choose to use those as opposed to what they would purchase on the street and thereby not be exposed to that risk of overdose or death. That's the theory that underlies the program.
And how's it worked out?
Well, it's not black and white. Obviously, it's been around for a while. Here in British Columbia, this past year, we set a record for the number of overdose deaths, over 2,500. So if the question is, has it led to a decrease in overdose deaths? Absolutely not. Is it a tool that we should be using in the context of other tools? That's probably true. So if people try to say, does it work or does it not work? The answer, from my point of view, it works in context, and it needs to be viewed in that way.
So you're on the east side of Vancouver. Your clinic is on the east side, correct?
Yeah, correct.
So you see a great deal of the issue happening in front of you and in your clinic. Can this program be refined at this point? Because, you know, we've been hearing, and you know far better than I'm asking questions here. We've been hearing that those addicted to drugs will get their package of drugs, and then they'll go to a dealer on the street and sell them, so they can buy more potent drugs and use the drugs they just received as at least a down payment. How much of that is going on?
Well, our chief public health officer, Dr. Bonnie Henry, recently admitted that that was happening without necessarily quantifying it. So it's real. It's something that that does happen. So that's why I am completely opposed to people who say, well, let's just make this safer supply, hydromorphone being the usual drug, trade name Dilaudid. Let's make it widely available, freely available without restriction, and that will solve the problem. If there is already some amount of diversion occurring with prescribed medications, then I think that this will just exacerbate the problem. This is why I'm not using the word safe supply anymore. I'm calling it supplementary opioid agonist therapy, OAT, opiate agonist therapy. We know this. It's methadone. It works. So what we're saying is methadone alone doesn't work. We need to supplement it. We need to put it in the context of a plan of care that is individualized and it is meant to help the individual that is seeking help at that point in time. And in that context, it may be that additional ingredient that's really going to help us engage the person better, help them deal with their addiction better, and that plus other services is going to be the key to it, not just safe supply alone.
So at this time, then today, you don't really have to prove that you're addicted. If I understand it, you don't have to prove that you're addicted. You have to declare that you're addicted. Then you become eligible to receive this, the ADT.
In its simplest form, that's right. So people who come in and say, I want safe supply, view it almost as something that they're entitled to. And we initiate a discussion. I have over 200 individuals who are on this supplementary opiate agonist therapy. And I tell them, look, this isn't a McDonald's. You got to come in and we got to talk. And we're going to try and individualize things, programs, interventions to your needs. And an extra tool in the toolbox is this hydromorphone, this Dilaudid. And I think if you view it in that way, it has a chance of being very helpful. If you view it as a solution, if this is what we need, we just need more safer supply and things are going to get better, then that's not true. If we view it as a right or an entitlement, that doesn't help us. We have to put it in context.
Dr. Conway, have you seen anyone who's actually been able to rid themselves of their drug addiction by using this ADT, this safer supply?
It, again, it has to do with, you know, what is it that you need that's going to help you get through this, that's going to decrease your cravings for street drugs, that is going to allow you to sort of rebuild a life that is free of street drug use. Some, they have medical issues, they have social issues that need to be addressed. And the only way that we're going to address that is by engaging people in care. The only way we're going to engage them in care is by addressing the addiction, using all the tools we have at our disposal, including the use of additional opiate therapies beyond the methadone and other things we've been used to in the past.
Is there political will to follow your lead and your advice that these drugs should not be available without a prescription? Is there the political will to engage that?
Well, it's interesting that when the coroner's report came out here in British Columbia suggesting that they be available without a prescription, within minutes, Premier of the province, Premier Eby, said, absolutely not, we're not doing that. So that is, you know, almost for sure not going to happen. But what has not yet been articulated properly is what is the role of this intervention in the broader picture of addressing the opioid crisis. And that is what I hope we will be working on in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah. Why would the premier listen to a doctor who's right in the middle of it, eh?
Well, an election's coming up. They tend to listen better when an election's coming up.
Yeah. Job insecurity. Dr. Conway, thank you. Appreciate the time today. Thanks so much.
Roy, always a pleasure. Be well.
There was a headline in the Toronto Star last week. 13 overdoses in less than an hour. Belleville, Ontario confronts an overwhelming overdose crisis. 55,000 people in Belleville. 13 overdoses in less than an hour. That's how bad it's getting. But that's some of what we talked about with Dr. Conway. Barry Ulmer with me now, the executive director of the Chronic Pain Association of Canada. And Barry, you and I have talked many times on and off the air. Thanks for joining us. How bad is it? First of all, how many chronic pain patients are there in this country?
I don't think anybody really knows, but the numbers, you know, are in the tens, hundreds of thousands, Roy, and it's getting worse because there's fewer and fewer doctors who are willing to work in the field.
Yes, yeah, so what is it, 10 or 15% of the population, right?
Yep.
So if we have 40 million people in this country, and it's 10%, that's 4 million.
It's a tremendous number.
It's a huge number of people. So in 2017, there was a guideline that was released by Health Canada, and the chairman of the, or the author of the guideline was a chiropractor at McMaster University who can't even prescribe Tylenol 3, but he was the author of this guideline, which brought a great distressing reality to chronic pain patients in this country. So how bad is it for the chronic pain patient, Barry, who was accustomed, even today may be accustomed, and have found a quality of life with prescribed opioids prescribed by a physician with whom this patient has had an ongoing and longstanding relationship dealing with chronic pain. How bad is it for the patient today?
It is tremendously bad, Roy. As I said, there's fewer and fewer doctors because of those guidelines and the policymakers going after physicians for prescribing. Most doctors have dropped out of the field, and it's getting worse even with their upcoming update of the guideline. It's just going to remain the same because of the percentage of medications that they want to use is even dropped more than it was then.
So for the person who is totally debilitated by the chronic pain they're living with and who is finding their opioid medication, which, again, prescribed, good relationship with the doctor, they understand each other, they make sure the prescription amount is commensurate with the need, that person, that patient, is in serious trouble. How often does it lead to thoughts of, attempts at, and actual committing of suicide?
Well, I don't think in Canada we have trouble coming here with numbers, but it is from our perspective and the calls and for information that are just getting worse and worse and worse. But just look at the MAID statistics and the number of people who are applying for use of the MAID situation, which, of course, as you know, the only reward for MAID is death, basically, and that's what they're using to control their pain. It's nonsense.
That's terrifying. So what about new guidelines, Barry? There's also talk about new guidelines to replace the ones from 2017.
Well, they've been reviewing the 2017 guidelines within 5 years. That's what we were told when they came out. However, we're now into the seventh year, and they finally, the group that's reviewing them have finally come out with allegedly guidelines, except they won't tell you what they are. They've recently sent out a survey asking of about 10 or 11 questions asking for views of people, and this is from all over the world, it's not Canadians, of what these new guidelines or the review would be. And even one of the examples in there is the amount of medication that they're recommending to use is not much better than what it's been. And we all know that people in severe chronic pain, that amount that they're allowed or they're suggesting to use won't touch most people's pain, especially those who are in severe pain. It just won't do it. We all know that.
Yeah. I've talked to so many chronic pain patients over the years, and we've done quite a few programs, as you know, and with you and with others, with patients who are in a very, very distressing reality. And they have nowhere to turn because, as you said, doctors have been who were prescribing and who were treating pain patients. Many have been chased out of that particular discipline. They're afraid that their colleges of physicians and surgeons will come down on them and threaten their license, no matter what the colleges say. I'm pretty sure. I mean, I've talked to doctors who've told me, yeah, actually, my license has been threatened. The colleges will say, no, we don't do that. But the doctors say, yeah, they do. It's a terrible world, a terrible reality for chronic pain patients, Barry. And the reality is any person could be the next person at any time. Yeah.
Well, without a doubt. I mean, you can just walk out on the street and fall and crack your ankle or something and nothing helps it. So anybody is prone to that sort of stuff. And there aren't any doctors that will treat them. We've been after Health Canada for years now. They keep coming up with these things, and we keep asking them, well, who's going to treat all these patients? And because of the lack of doctors, and they have no explanation, and they're not spending money on it. Yet here we see now that they're spending money on American cable TV advertising some services that don't really exist. We all know that, and it's just becoming ridiculous.
Yeah, you put me in touch with a couple in their 60s a couple of years ago. And the gentleman had been used to opioid medications prescribed by his doctor, and then the doctor got afraid and stopped prescribing. And the gentleman he attempted suicide, and it was his wife who found him and saved his life. What a terrible, terrible situation, and so damned unnecessary. Mr. Ulmer, thank you for everything you do. It's the Chronic Pain Association of Canada, and our listeners should get behind you.
Thanks very much, Roy. It's nice to be with you.
Always good talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.